City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph, and this is edition 266. On the program this week, I am going to be featuring a conversation with a community organizer who has long visited the intersections of local activist work, migrant justice struggles, and we were talking particularly about some of the challenges that activist movements and community organizing faces in the context of Canada today, with a rising conservative party linked to right-wing neo-Nazi movements, while also carrying the ideology of extreme neoliberal free market economics, disguised through a populist discourse. I thought it was important to speak with somebody who was doing a lot of organizing the last time a conservative government was in power in Canada under Stephen Harper. Bill was involved in organizing against the G20 summit in Toronto. That is the summit of world leaders taking place behind closed doors with no democratic access, often focused on economic policy, not on the needs of communities. These summits have been protested around the world for the symbolism of that space really as an exclusive space. And the summit in Canada in 2010 was vigorously protested by many community groups and activist organizations. Bill was one person who was involved in that and also was jailed under a conservative government. I thought it'd be interesting to hear his perspective on thinking about power, thinking about community organizing in the context of the threat of a rising conservative party in Canada. The last 2025 elections in Canada showed that the conservative party gained a lot of votes and seats, although they did not form government. They did win over through political manipulation a lot of people. So it's important, I think, to think back and reflect on what community organizing looked like under the last conservative government. So here's my conversation on that for Free City Radio.
Yeah, so I guess maybe to try to give some context for people. So this was in the context of a movement that's usually referred to as the anti-globalization movement. So this was a global movement, and we would have thought of ourselves as being led by the global South and basically the countries that are being pillaged by the G20. But at least in the global North, there was basically a protest culture of its own that emerged around around this movement and these demonstrations that would happen. So basically, it was like opposing these kind of big institutions. So like the G20, like the International Monetary Fund will give out loans to countries, but with strict conditions about how they have to restructure their economy to serve the global North. Institutions like the World Bank and so on and so forth. And so when I kind of politically came of age and was kind of getting into activism and organizing and that stuff, that was in the early 2000s. So we were kind of coming off big victories in Seattle, and in Quebec City, where there were these large international summits happening, and then the counter summit protests. By the time 2010 had rolled around, that movement was basically petering off. Like I think those previous protests I mentioned were kind of like the high water mark. But then there was a generation of people like me who were heavily inspired and influenced by them. So on the one hand, there was the politics around why it felt necessary to, just on principle, to oppose the idea that all the rich people get together and basically like supervillains and make their like world domination plans.
Literally.
Yeah. And so like why it's like, well, you know, it's to have that happen, you know, in your own backyard and for it to go unopposed is sort of humiliating. And And also, we were talking about this earlier too, but the idea that the, like, socially the context was different at the time because, and I was saying that, you know, in my view, I think the big contribution of that movement was introducing into the public discourse this idea that capitalism is actually bad, which today just feels like so obvious or so just like, well, everybody knows that. Like, we all feel that every day. Like, that's like, it's no longer in question. But at that time, like in the late 90s, you know, there was this idea of, like the end of history, like communism has been defeated and now capitalism reigns supreme and neoliberalism or neoconservatism or whatever you call it is like, you know, the consensus of, you know, of all politicians, all politics, like whether you're liberal or conservative or Republican or Democrat, there's not actually much light between them around all of these big questions. And the idea was that, you know, this is the best system that the world ever could have, and that now we just have to sit back and enjoy this. And so the idea of just openly being anti-capitalist felt very radical at the time. Like, even if in retrospect maybe it wasn't as radical as we thought it was, it felt like this huge departure and this very radical statement to take that was typically just kind of dismissed immediately. And so that's kind of the context. And I also think, if I'm being honest about it too, because it was a ritual, or I felt like these protests had become ritualized by that point, like people like me, so at the time I was in kind of like the anarchist milieu and for years had watched videos of these protests and they were iconic. But I was just a bit too young and had missed those myself. And so I think there was also a generation of people who were like, wanted to go through this ritual. So yeah, it was announced that the G20 was coming. It was going to be in Toronto, and, you know, without anything being announced, it was just, everyone just understood that, of course, there's going to be a large counter-summit mobilization. So that led to lots of organizing. I was living outside of Guelph, or outside of Toronto at the time. I was in Guelph, which is just outside of Toronto. And the networks I was part of at the time tended to kind of coordinate along the lines of Southern Ontario. So so it wasn't just Toronto mobilizing. It was also Guelph, Kitchener, Hamilton, Waterloo, Kingston, and then, of course, with that, like you mentioned, comes repression. And so I think that's kind of what the G20 is most remembered for, this kind of like spectacular, over-the-top police violence against protesters and also against random people, like the downtown core being transformed into this hyper-violent police state for a few days. More than a few days, actually, because there was also the weeks leading up to the protests where there was a barrier erected cutting across downtown and lots of stuff like that. And then also there was kind of this behind-the-scenes stuff around how the police surveyed and monitored movements and actually infiltrated movements. That led to myself and several other organizers being arrested and facing criminal charges, actually, because there were undercover police officers who had been kind of part of our activist community, or posing as part of our activist community, for actually like about a year and a half by that point. So a very long-term operation that actually took a lot of significant resources on their part.
I think it's probably important to just underline a few points. One is this, when you talked about the global north versus the global south, that obviously the critique of the G20 is around the economic system, and there are southern countries that are member states to the G20, but those are that voice is represented by the governments of, you know, let's say India, not the people. And, you know, in the context of India with the extreme right government now, we can see the wealth inequality is just huge. During this time you're talking about in 2010, it was also really understood that there was a really strong relationship between the Conservative Party of Canada and corporations and, you know, the banking, oil and gas, other types of companies. Right now, we're seeing this very strange moment where the Conservative Party is trying to sell themselves as pro-working class. They have this sort of, like, working man discourse, you know, quote unquote. And I think it's important maybe to sort of underline how cozy and close the relationship is between the Conservative Party and corporations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there, like back then there were similar things of like, I think there were like the Conservatives also would have claimed at the time that they represent working people. But there wasn't the, I think you're right that the, now it's more of a populist kind of a thing, that there has been this shift towards less of a neoconservative kind of right-wing politics and more towards a populist, more kind of like overtly fascist kind of right-wing politics. But yeah, I think because of like the, like what I was saying about like the neoliberalism of the time. So like, for instance, like around the G20 mobilizing, yeah. Like, there were maybe some groups that talked about Harper and stuff like that, but in the core organizing and the main messaging, that was kind of mostly ignored. And I think part of the reason for that was this feeling of like, you know, we can see the difference in rhetoric, for instance, between the Conservatives and the Liberals. But in terms of questions of policy, there was almost no light between them, especially around things like... like this global trade kind of stuff that we're talking about. Around questions of free trade, no light between them. Around their policies and their engagements with the G20 and the World Bank and the IMF and the World Trade Organization, everyone, no light between them. And I think it's also interesting to note, too, that like, when people... Because I do think there was a tendency to associate some of the police repression with Harper at the time, because Harper was the one who announced like a $1 billion security budget for this summit, which at the time was quite shocking. Like of course, for the idea that it's actually just a one-weekend event, a price tag like that, but also just like $1 billion in 2010 was more than $1 billion now. Like, it was a bit eye-popping at the time, and I think that did help pave the way for that kind of spending on police becoming more normalized. So now it's like, you know, $1 billion on an annual police budget is something that we kind of hear all the time. And I think in the mainstream is strangely, we've become accustomed to that. And also the militarization of police and the equipment they use and the resources they consume. So we can see it in all of that trajectory. But I think... you know, the on the ground, what it looked like, I think you could see it as kind of a clear continuation, for instance, of Quebec City and Seattle. So, for instance, in Seattle, where they were actually, protesters succeeded in actually shutting down the summit. Yeah. And so that's in 99. And then in 2001, when there's the Free Trade Area of the Americas protest in Quebec City that, of course, had a huge impact on politics here in Montreal and the organizing networks that we're now a part of. For that protest, that was well known for the fence that they erected to try to keep protesters out. And so that was again used at the Toronto G20. So, for instance, the... when the Quebec City protests happened, that was the Liberals who were in power then. And for the Toronto G20, my own personal view is that the extraordinary police violence that we saw, I don't think that that was ever their plan or their intention for that to happen. I think there was plenty of violence leading up, like violent arrests, like, but more along the lines of individuals who were targeted and things like that. the idea of just the, like, you know, the police wading into a crowd of people waving their batons and smashing everyone. Like the images from the Sunday of that weekend that came to kind of define the whole summit. In my view, I think that was actually a somewhat spontaneous reaction to the fact that the day before the police completely failed at controlling the Black Bloc, who basically kind of went on a rampage through the financial core of the city, and there were police cars burned, and that became an iconic image as well. The police cruiser that was up in flames on Bay Street, and Bay Street being the kind of like the Wall Street of Toronto. So this kind of symbolic thing, and that even with their $1 billion and all of their years of preparation, that they weren't able to control those protests. I think they were humiliated, like, I think just at a personal level, and you could see that in the officers on the ground, that they were actually just viscerally angry. But it went all the way up to the top, right up to Bill Blair, the police chief. And there's another example that kind of points out how the partisan distinctions are actually murky, because, of course, Bill Blair today is a Liberal cabinet member. So I think the idea of putting all of this on the Conservatives is an overly simplistic conclusion that some people would have reached at the time, whereas I think it's more just kind of the natural progression of how, as our movements grow and learn, the police state is also growing and learning, and they change their tactics of repression as well.
Well, there's a lot there to unpack, and just for people who are listening to this in other places, or maybe if you're not familiar with the term Black Bloc, it's basically a group of protesters who cover their identity with face coverings in order to carry out direct actions, usually direct actions that targeted corporations that really speak to, like, global inequality, like banks having their windows broken, things like that. But in a way, like, what you're describing is interesting, well, many layers, but one thing I thought of while you were speaking, and I think it's important we find a language for this, is, like, there was a lot of more mainstream coverage of the repression at the G20 that you were talking about in Toronto, not from the activist point of view, but let's say from media organizations or academics, that really did make the connection between Harper, the Conservatives, and the repression. And you know, it's interesting because that's also the same types of people that see Liberals as sort of a progressive alternative to that, right? And then we sort of always get lost in this cycle where a lot of people with power and influence who aren't involved in, like, community work and activism and dealing with, like, injustices, you know, that whether it's around immigration policy, whether it's around economic issues, you know, that are more just commenting and not really involved, always sort of haven't in the past been able to sort of tip the discussion towards this, like, mythology of the Liberals being progressive. Not sort of see this connection. And I'm mentioning that in the present because we're already starting to see, with the threat of a Conservative government in Canada, this sort of, like, cloak of progressive discourse from a lot of people who see somehow as the Liberals, you know, as an alternative to the Conservatives in terms of, like, safeguarding policy. Whereas, you know, it's pretty obvious that sometimes Liberals will make concessions to social movements, often very few, but it's really social movements that have pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed for things. But yeah, I just thought it might be interesting to hear your thoughts about that.
Yeah, I recognize the same thing too. They're kind of, like, at best presenting Liberals as the lesser of two evils, and then, yeah, we're actually celebrating them as a genuine alternative. So, for instance, like, to use the example maybe of the way that the violence at the G20 was kind of used in opposition to Harper, like, picked up on people, the kind of ideology you're describing. I think the thing we have to remember about that violence is that what was exceptional about it is that it was experienced by a lot of people like me, like I'm a white upper middle class guy. And I think the kind of demographics that were making up that protest, and if we want to get into that too, we can talk about, there were lots of critiques of the anti-globalization movement for that, of being, especially around black bloc tactics and things like that, of being very white and male, and there being a machismo and a kind of a high level of privilege, and the privilege of being able to go from summit to summit to attend these protests. The term summit hopping was coined to describe this kind of counterculture that emerged around that. I'll maybe just explain a little bit the timeline of the what happened in Toronto for people who weren't there. So it was a weekend summit. So there was kind of like a Friday opening protest that was more kind of family friendly. Saturday there was a big kind of more mainstream union march, but then marching with them was this Black Bloc contingent, which split away from that march. And like you were saying, that was a group that embraced tactics of economic disruption, was the term used at the time. So the idea was basically like causing economic damage to create deterrence for these kind of things. So the idea of like the same institutions that profit from all of these policies will target them in this moment. And so banks were targeted, large corporations, things like that.
Like institutions that benefit from global inequality.
Exactly, yeah. So that protest happened, and those direct actions happened in a way that was quite sensationalized and quite shocking to just kind of society in general, you know, like images of windows being smashed and burning police cars. And so the next day, what happened is that police basically cracked down on all protests, like surrounding all protests, arresting everyone in them. And also like at Queen's Park, just outside the Ontario Legislature, where a protest was happening, there were, and this was, you know, in front of journalists and being filmed, and just totally over the top, police beating people, people sustaining really serious injuries, having limbs broken, all of this kind of stuff. People being taken to the massive detention center that had been set up just for this weekend. I think it was over 1,000 people were arrested. It was, at the time at least, it was the largest mass arrest in Canadian history. So this was all kind of deemed as quite shocking at the time. And that was the language used, even on the left, that was a lot of the language that was used. But I think we need to remember that what was shocking about all of that is that there was a lot of privilege amongst those protesters. And eventually they were rounding up. There were then spontaneous protests outside of the detention center. And then they were just arresting anyone who was walking down the street. So people who had nothing to do with protests were getting rounded up. You've got people who don't usually experience this kind of state violence, who don't usually get to see what the court system is like. They don't go through it themselves. They don't see the criminal justice system. They don't see what it means to be in police detention. And they're seeing this all for the first time and are rightfully enraged by it, but are mistakenly concluding that something like this has never happened before.
Or is not systemic.
Exactly. And there were kind of lots of moments that really illustrated this for me. So for instance, I was in a group that we were held for longer because we were basically kind of scapegoated as, we were accused of being ringleaders of protest. And so we didn't get released as quickly as a lot of the other people who were, we weren't released from the detention center. Most of us were transferred to Maplehurst Prison, which is a provincial prison. And when we first got there, there was enough of us that we had our own range in the jail. So I'll kind of explain what that means. So the way jails are usually set up, or modern jails, there's kind of like the panopticon thing of like, so imagine a pie that's been cut into slices. At the center of the pie, you've kind of got the prison guards with their little command center, kind of. And then each pie slice is a different range. So that's kind of like your living area when you're in jail. So they can see in, they can see what's happening. And then along the back edge of that, so where kind of the crust of the pie would be, that's where you've got your actual cells. So in the morning, the cells open, you come out into your range, as it's called, and you've got tables and a TV, and that's kind of where you spend the day. So when we first got there, we had our own range. It was everyone from the protest. And then eventually, as people were getting released, the range got emptier and emptier. And I think the prison was like, okay, we can no longer justify having this whole range set aside just for them. And they started transferring in folks from the general population, the Gen Pop prisoners. And we all talked about at the time that it was like this color-coded thing, because in our whole group, at that point when they started doing that, we had, on our side of the G20 protesters, we had one visible person of color. Everyone else was white. And they start transferring prisoners from the Gen Pop in, and every single one of them is black. And we talked about it, it's like, oh, from their panopticon, they can color code us. They can see exactly who's from the G20 protests and who isn't. And it was also kind of clear to us, too, that we were being treated with the kids' gloves. Like, they were being careful with us, because I think partly because there was so much attention on the whole situation and it was so mediatized. I think also because of our privilege. I think they were looking at us being like, man, we don't know of these kids, like, whose dad is a lawyer or something. Like, I think so. And, you know, there were, I remember having like this embarrassing interaction with one of the prisoners myself, where someone from our side went to go change the channel on the TV. This is a big no-no. There's rules around stuff like this with the prisoners. And I was trying to play the peacemaker. I went over to try to smooth things over, to be like, you know, be like, hey, I'm going to apologize on behalf of the other guy. Like, I'm sorry. He's like, he's not a bad guy. He's stressed out. He doesn't know when he's going home. And this guy looks at me and he says, we are home. He says, this is our home. He says, I've been here 3 years. Like, I'm not going home next week. And it, like, it was a wake up moment for me. It was like, you know, embarrassing that I couldn't have thought of that for myself. But, you know, the violence that this guy in front of me was experiencing, which is so much more extreme than the violence that I was experiencing. And all of the leftists who are kind of rushing to my defense aren't talking about how Harper's responsible for his situation, because the truth is that he's not. He would have been in the same situation under Chrétien before him, or under Trudeau after him. So I think there is a bigger, I think that's why I often refer to the G20 violence as spectacular or sensational, because it's not that the police don't do those, it's not that they don't beat people every day or arrest people without good reason every day, or that people aren't abused in custody every day, but that for this one weekend, all of society was paying attention to that for a change, and it was happening to people that it doesn't usually happen to. Usually it happens to people who are poorer, and communities of color, and black and indigenous communities, and migrant communities that are targeted. So I think we also have to keep that in mind in terms of what we think of as exceptional levels of oppression, and implicitly what that means we've actually accepted, the violence that we've accepted that we're not challenging.
That was a conversation with longtime community activist and organizer Bill, speaking about his reflections on the last conservative government in Canada, experiences at the G20 protests, and also being imprisoned in that context. I was really happy to speak with Bill for the program. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. on CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m. on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Friday at 5:30 a.m. on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. and on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We are also a podcast. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio. I'm your host, Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week.